From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, director John Waters talks about his new comedy, Pecker, about a mischievous young photographer from blue-collar Baltimore who becomes the darling of the New York art world. And of course, we'll ask the king of bad taste his impressions of the Star Report. Also, we talk with historian Eric Foner. His new book, The Story of American Freedom, is about the debates, disagreements, and struggles that have defined freedom in America. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. The overall global rout on world markets shows no sign of abating today. The downward spiral by financial markets that struck Wall Street yesterday apparently isn't over yet. NPR's business correspondent Jack Spear joins us live. Jack, this is the second day that the stock market has taken a major hit, and it was just this week the Federal Reserve Board moved to cut interest rates. Isn't this the opposite of what the Fed hoped to achieve?
Well, it usually is, Corva, and what we've seen here are a couple of unique factors that are moving the markets in the wrong direction, clearly, for U.S. investors. What's happened here is that the market, in many respects, had already programmed in this quarter of a point cut in the federal funds rate. And the overall doom and gloom of the third quarter, which was the worst for U.S. Stock market in 8 years, just keeps dragging things down here today.
So what areas of the markets are the worst affected?
Well, technology companies have been taking big hits and continue to do so amid just kind of an overall global downturn in terms of semiconductors. But it's really a broad stretch of the economy that's being hit here. Retail shares have fallen. Bank stocks are down to some extent. Just kind of a broad sell-off.
This doesn't look good. So what are the prospects for the fourth quarter? What are they going to be like?
Well, right now the prospects aren't so good. Overall, we're still predicting a 2% growth rate for the year for 1998. But based on what we've seen for the past quarter, the third quarter, things aren't good. Obviously, most manufacturers are hoping for a little bit of an uptick. In fact, we did have a purchasing management report out today that did at least show for the latest period that things held the line for the month of September, but we did not see an expansion.
Thanks a lot, NPR's business correspondent, Jack Spear. A U.S.-brokered Middle East peace deal might include the release of an American convicted of spying for Israel. NPR's Jennifer Ludden reports from Jerusalem.
Israeli officials say they're negotiating with the U.S. for the release of Jonathan Pollard. He's now serving a life sentence in North Carolina. The former U.S. Naval Intelligence Officer was caught more than a decade ago passing on information about Arab countries, information he said the U.S. had withheld from its allies. At the time, Israel refused Pollard sanctuary in its Washington embassy, but last May, for the first time, Israeli officials acknowledged Pollard was their agent. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says Pollard's potential release was raised during his visit to the White House Monday, but that no agreement has yet been reached. The release would be part of a plan for Israel to hand over another 13% of West Bank land to the Palestinians. I'm Jennifer Ludden, NPR News, Jerusalem.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials are down 168 points at 76.73. This is NPR. In NPR's business update, the International Monetary Fund has applauded the U.S. Federal Reserve for cutting a key interest rate this week. But IMF Managing Director Michel Camdessou says other countries must do more now to stop the spreading global financial crisis. Camdessou says the world's seven richest countries must push for stronger growth to help stop financial bleeding in many Asian nations and in Russia. He warns that poor bank supervision helped start the financial crisis and that financial systems around the world must be strengthened. Negotiators for Bell South and the Communications Workers of America are back at the bargaining table after the union turned down a utilities contract. From Peach State Public Radio in Atlanta, Mike Savage reports.
Workers for the Atlanta-based telecommunications company have turned down a utilities contract that was part of a three-year agreement ratified by the union just before a midnight strike deadline August 8th. The utilities contract covers more than 300 Bell South employees who handle buried installation work in Georgia and eight other southern states. Bell South spokeswoman Deborah Spicer says contract talks between the two sides are ongoing while utility workers continue to do their jobs.
There is absolutely no disruption to service. The discussions are taking place, and you know, we'll just work with the union to figure out what the issues and concerns are for those few employees.
Spicer says the company is confident an agreement will be reached soon. Bell South employs more than 48,000 union workers in the Southeast. For NPR News, I'm Mike Savage in Atlanta.
Bowling equipment maker Brunswick says it's consolidating some operations and will cut 750 jobs. Brunswick has blamed poor economic conditions in Asia. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from Borders Books and Music, offering a world to explore through books and music. Location information, 800-644-7733.
Support for NPR comes from The Imposters, the new comedy from Stanley Tucci, one of the creators of Big Night. Opens nationally October 2nd.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. It's usually with great affection that people refer to film director John Waters as the king of bad taste. He earned his crown with his early works, such as Pink Flamingos, in which the main characters vied for the title The Filthiest Person Alive. When Pink Flamingos had its 25th anniversary re-release last year, Waters said, "It's hard to offend three generations, but it looks like I've succeeded." Waters' latest movies have more to do with making audiences laugh than offending them. Waters' comedies like Polyester, Hairspray, and Serial Mom are, as he puts it, about people who are nuts but think they're the sane ones. His affection for these characters always comes through. His new movie, Pecker, is set in Baltimore, Waters' hometown. It stars Edward Furlong as a young man who takes pictures of everything around him. He creates an exhibit of his photographs on the walls of the Greasy Spoon where he works. A New York gallery owner sees it, loves it, and suddenly Pecker's world collides with the New York art world, and his life is turned upside down. I asked John Waters to describe the character of Pecker.
Pecker is certainly an innocent Fred John Waters character, but he's not stupid, and he's a local photographer in kind of a blue-collar neighborhood in Baltimore that is obsessed by taking pictures of every single thing around him, from the cheeseburger that's sizzling on the grill where he's a short-order cook to his very strange grandmother who believes that the statue of the Virgin Mary in her bedroom talks to her nightly. All the things Pecker takes picture with, and he got his nickname from picking at his food as a child, was that he thinks are completely normal. He's used to them, and he is merely recording for his own obsession the world around him. So that is what Pecker is like. And he's still a good guy when the New York art world notices him for all the right reasons. They like his pictures for the right reasons. They're not looking down on him. But they are taking his images out of context. And that is where the dreaded irony enters the picture and changes Pecker's life and his world around him.
And what is so dreaded about irony?
Nothing. I make my living from irony. Irony is paying for the cup of coffee that is sitting right here I'm drinking. That is what I sell. But I am the first to realize that irony is snobbery. Irony is a class thing. Certainly, if you're so hungry, nothing is so bad it's good. Irony is infected in all American culture. It's the main thing in all culture, on television, in radio, everything. But so sometimes I get weary of it. But I'm being hypocritical myself because I celebrate irony in all my movies. That's the main subject matter usually.
How would you compare yourself as an artist to Pecker?
Well, I never say the dreaded art word. I mean, that is up to history to decide. Not even your peers, the real meaning of the word art. I think I'm a film director and a writer, really. They're very different in some ways because I knew the irony. I was in on it from the beginning. I wanted the New York world. I wanted showbizes to discover my movies. And I made it not very hard. I mean, I sent them press releases, so it's not exactly like they stumbled upon it in the beginning. But at the same time, the subject matter that Pecker takes pictures of, I may have taken those same characters and turned them into my own characters through writing and exaggerating them and everything. I don't think Pecker exaggerates them or takes them and puts them into any other form than the form that exists in.
And he was so interested in the details of his world. I have a feeling that you were kind of bored by the details of your world, so you made up this kind of fictional world that was larger than life.
Certainly. Whatever I was obsessed by, and obsession was one of the first feelings I remember as a child, and not negatively. It's not like I couldn't step on the crack or I'd break my mother's back. I wasn't that crazy.
Well, that might be compulsion anyways.
Well, yeah. But I wasn't obsessional neuroses, like where I had to, you know, like have tic syndromes and have to do things over and over, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. But I did get very interested in things that I knew from the very beginning no other children were interested in, and my interest made my parents nervous. So I tended to keep it secret. And at the same time, I would exaggerate it and make it much more ludicrous and insane than it was in real life. So maybe I was bored. I was bored in school, certainly. And it seems like after I learned how to read and write very well in grade school, but I didn't learn much else that they're supposed to teach you in school afterwards. But in junior high, I learned about scary girl delinquents that really I use as much as reading and writing in my later work. And in college, and in high school, I learned about defiance and being against authority, which is certainly I also used in my movies. But after grade school, my interests were very much discouraged.
Can you think of something that obsessed you as a kid that later entered your work?
Well, I've talked about it so many times about car accidents I used to play as a child, and I put it in Female Trouble, and then people were wondering why I love the movie Crash, basically, but now I don't even look at a car accident. You know, once it ends up in my movie, sometimes it's over with. Certainly Hairspray, I was obsessed with this television show, the Buddy Dean show that came on in Baltimore. But the kids that were on it every day, I drew them and exaggerated and made up insane biographies about how they stabbed the principal and stuff, and just to try to amuse myself. So those were two that come to mind, certainly in the beginning.
John Waters is my guest, and his new movie is called Pecker. The character is named Pecker because, as a child, he only pecked at his food.
Well, my director of photography said, why isn't his name Picker then? Which is a point. Certainly, I knew that I was trying to have a title that I could push as far as I could go and get away with it. And I did get away with it, except in Oklahoma City and Tulsa, where they refused to run the title. But I don't think we're playing there anyway, so it really wasn't that much of an issue.
What if your film was called Pecker the Woodpecker? Would they have not?
Well, there was many titles. I mean, still shocks me. How did they ever get away with that? Today, I don't think you could. I mean, that one seems more offensive than any title, really. But I brought up Free Willy, which I think is is the most. Willy and Pecker, in a dirty way, are the same kind of, very close in meaning. It's just the English way to say Pecker. The Motion Picture Association of America initially turned it down, but only because they saw the title. They didn't know what it was or anything. We had a hearing, and they overturned it unanimously. They were very fair about it, actually.
Do you like playing?
But I had to go to court. It was like OJ. You know, I had to wait in the other room and then come in, and they didn't look at me. And I thought, oh, God, I've lost.
What did you have to say in defense of yourself in court?
Well, we had lawyers who also talked, and then I gave a little speech saying that, you know, the word pecker is never found in obscenity. If you try to talk dirtily with the word pecker, people would laugh in your face. Men rarely refer to their penis as a pecker. It's a threatening word to men. It means little in a way. Women use the word mostly to their kids, I think. I think it's a word that makes women laugh and men uptight. It's also, as I said, no child ever angrily carved the word pecker in his school desk. I mean, it's not a hostile word at all, I don't think. And I said, in this case, the movie is about a young photographer who wants his good name back. And in this case, the good name is Pecker. We laughed. They came back in and they unanimously overturned it.
Do you take a lot of pleasure in using a word that some people think of dirty, but on the other hand, it has different meanings, and depending on the context, the whole color of the word is changed?
Yeah, and I found a dictionary that I took with me that only had one definition, pecker. Something, a person who takes food with a sudden movement of his head. And I doubt anyone has said that word in that definition ever in the history of language. You know what I mean? Oh, how could you say it that way in a sentence? I don't know what it would be. I guess a bird is
a bird
pecker,
pecks at his food, yeah.
Yeah, but pecker, the word, it said one who takes food with a sudden movement of his head. And I it had no other definition, and I neglected to tell the MPAA that really the dictionary copyright was 1957.
My chicken.
When they couldn't put those kind of words in the dictionary.
John Waters is my guest, and his new movie is called Pecker. Now, one of the games in your movie, I thought this was really a scream. This is a game called Shopping for Others. Would you describe how it's played?
Well, it's really not an original idea. It came from my friend Greg Gorman, who plays himself in the movie The Photographer, and he plays this game with his chef in Beverly Hills. And you go into a food store and you put in other shoppers' carts items that they would never, ever buy when they don't see you. Like you put in Spam, a rich person, or like, I don't know, Preparation H to a muscle man. You know, things that they'd be really embarrassed to have in their cart. And then it causes anarchy in the supermarket. And it's a harmless form of food terrorism, really. And I've done it, and people have done it to me in the Giant here when I came back home. So you have to, now I have to, every time I go to the supermarket, watch my cart to make sure that somebody doesn't do it to me.
Oh, so this is a game that two adults play now that you know, huh?
Yes. And they go further. Actually, what they do that I didn't put in because I thought it might cause a dangerous trend is they unwrap a candy bar and hand it to a child in the back of the cart when the mother isn't looking. And then she turns around and says, "Hey, where'd you get that?" and smacks its hand, you know. "Put that back." And the child's like, "Oh," like sitting there.
A lot of the locales in your movie are, you know, diners and cheap bars. And one of the bars is called the Pelt Room, and it's a lesbian strip joint with heterosexual male clientele. And so all the men in the joint are always verbally abused by the lesbian strippers as they dance.
Right.
It's very funny. How did you think this up?
Well, I think, you know, basically that one of the top male heterosexual fantasies is lesbians. And they believe that they're going to give them what they really need, when in reality, that is the last thing they really need. And Divine and I used to see a stripper at the Gaiety Burlesque in Baltimore, who this is based on. Only she didn't even strip. She just came out nude. And she looked like Johnny Cash. And she would look at the audience and say, "What are you looking at?" And they loved it. And I never got over it. I've been talking about it for 30 years. So I finally put it in a movie.
My guest is film director John Waters. His new movie is called Pecker. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is screenwriter and director John Waters. His new movie is the comedy Pecker. Now, Pecker's grandmother in your movie is somebody who has, you know, a statue of the Virgin Mary, but she thinks the statue's talking to her.
Well, she helps it along like a ventriloquist.
Exactly.
I mean, she fools herself, really. She says, "Full of grace," all the time. I think it's kind of
reverent. Is that your voice, by the way, in the movie?
It's not mine, no. It is Jean Shirtler, the actress who is playing the part. But, of course, at the end, there is a real miracle, and that is a heavenly voice that I interviewed about 30 women over the phone for the voiceover, and it was like dial a prayer. They called me every 10 minutes and did the Hail Mary for me, and I picked the voice over the phone.
And did you know anybody who was like this, who had a statue of the Virgin and believed that she was talking?
No, I did not know that. But I was a puppeteer when I was a child. And in Baltimore, people have religious statues a lot in their window. I mean, you see them really a lot. And I think I just put the two things together. And my hobby is extreme Catholic behavior before the Reformation. And I have a lot of books about Mariolatry, the extreme undue worship of Mary. And I'm kind of obsessed by it because the people that get into Mary are really into her. I mean, this is a cult. This is beyond Jim Jones. I mean, and there's a new cult that believes that Mary is better than Christ because she had him. And these debates to me are so strange and so surreal that I am very interested in it. And it seems if there ever is going to be a real miracle, it will be Mary. She appears more than anybody else in Phony Ones. So why it goes along in thinking to think if there ever is going to be a real one, that it will be Mary.
You were brought up Catholic, right?
Half Catholic, yes. I went to private school and Catholic Sunday school, which is a real, quite a combination, believe me, because they only have you one day a week, so they really got to get you there. You know, they only got you 1 hour. So the most extreme Catholic stuff, they would tell you. And I remember as a child feeling like I was on Mars or something, you know, that all the nuns would tell us this stuff that I thought, my God, I've never heard of these movies. I'm not going to do any of this stuff. I'm 6 years old. But, you know what I'm saying? But they told me about all these mortal sins that I never even knew about, really. So they were my guidance counselor in filth, really.
So this is how you got your interest developed in extreme Catholic behavior?
Yes, yeah, by seeing it as a child and being amazed. I mean, they would say, you will burn in hell if you see these movies. How would I see these movies? I was six. What, was I going to go downtown to a burlesque house at 7 years old? You know, I don't know how they thought I was going to get there, even if I wanted to see them.
You've described yourself as making movies about people who are crazy but think that they're sane. I think that's a pretty good description.
Yeah, because so many people I know in New York are insane and they're happy about it, and that's why they moved to New York, to celebrate that. And I would describe most of my friends that way. But to me, I make movies about people that think they're the most normal people in the world, but to me seem even more insane, and that's what interests me.
Now, a couple of the characters in Pecker are homeless, and I'm wondering if you talk much with homeless people and if there are any homeless people who you've kind of adopted in a way, who you bring food for or hang out with and talk.
There was a woman that used to live with Edith Massey named Jean that was in some of my earlier movies. And
yeah, and Edith Massey is known to John Waters fans as Edie the Egg Lady.
Yeah. And Edie took her in, actually, and that was the one I knew the best. And it was, she would never let water touch her body. So she was like the Wicked Witch of the West. She watched and washed in rubbing alcohol. And every night she and Edith would watch two separate televisions in the same room, the same show. Because they kept it private, you know. And she worked for Edie, and really they tried to give her money, but all she wanted was Pall cigarettes and a can of SpaghettiOs. So her needs were really not so much. And at the end, when Edie died, she went back on the streets, and people offered to give her apartments and everything, and she would never, ever do it. It was very, very sad, because she didn't believe Edie died, and that was the only person that she would ever go inside and live somewhere with. And she looked great. She looked like Sonia Rykiel, the designer. She had a great look, accidentally. So I know that's probably very politically incorrect to think of homeless and fashion together. But in this movie, Pecker's mother tries to help the homeless by teaching them fashion sense. And certainly some of the most expensive and the most eccentric designers today, their clothes are rags in a way, and it does look like homeless. So in the movie, when the homeless people and the New Yorkers get together, they're dressed alike. And they realize that, and they sort of celebrate that.
Did Edie take in the woman who you were describing as an act of charity, or because she just felt emotionally connected to her?
Edie just liked her. She helped Edie. You know, she was kind of Edie's assistant. And we all liked Jean. She was great. And then she ended up, she was in Desperate Living. And she used to come to all the Christmas parties, all the parties. She came, everything. She'd get real dressed up, a big Christmas corsage. And she was great. And it just was very, very sad. And I know that she's put away today somewhere in a place. I hear she's okay. I know one person that visits her. But when she was out, she would not go back in a place. You could not get her. It wasn't money. It wasn't anything. It was just, I think, that she felt cooped up anywhere else. If so, she likes sleeping on the street, and they wouldn't let her eventually.
John Waters is my guest, and his new movie is called Pecker. I'd love to get some of your impressions of The Star Report. I mean, a lot of people say it's almost something John Waters could have written. Have you been following this carefully?
I have been following it. I don't think it's very witty. I think I certainly know people, and I'm not even saying myself, that have done worse. I'm not going to judge another man's private life. At the same time, I feel bad for him. I think he should go to Mortville, actually, which is the town in Desperate Living where you get sentenced to if you're so embarrassed by something that you've done. but other than that, I guess how can you not read about it? But I'm weary of it. And, you know, Linda Tripp, to me, is the one that should be in prison. I mean, with friends like that, no wonder she was doing that kind of thing in the White House. I mean, I don't know. The whole thing, to me, is bad, bad taste. I would never put any of those women in my movies, and I still really like Bill Clinton.
I'm wondering, you know, as someone who does wear the crown as the king of bad taste, as someone who has, you know, challenged what most people consider the standards of decency in so many of your movies, particularly the early ones, do you think that the way The Star Report has been handled is kind of changing public standards of good taste?
Well, it's been handled in a completely political way and using fear of sex in a political way, which is very Republican to me. Basically, the only good thing, I have a friend that said this, is that every person in America is talking about sex. I've heard my parents say things about sex to me more than they've ever said in their whole life. I said on the Jay Leno show, it's true that all people are so worried about their children. What do we tell our children? Just say she took patriotism to a new level, really. she honored her flag. It's not the worst thing that could have happened. He wasn't bombing a country. They had sexual fantasies, and they did them. I like sexual fantasies. I hope they keep these sexual fantasies, and 20 years later, when they're in a sort of their marriage is maybe a little boring, think of them, and it will perk up their sex life. That's the only good that I think they can use whatever happened for, and I hope they do remember it fondly.
Well, here's what I'm wondering. You had to go to court to defend your right to name your new movie Pecker.
Well, picture court. It wasn't like I was in handcuffs. I've always thought there should be a motion picture jail, but I wasn't threatened with it.
Nevertheless, I mean, you had to bring in lawyers and fight for your right to name your new movie Pecker. At the same time, very explicit testimony was put on the internet by the House Judiciary Committee. President Clinton testifying about intimate sexual details shown on television. What does that make you think about?
It makes me laugh that the Supreme Court may have to rule if oral sex is in fact sex. And that could be the final thing. And that will be, you have to admit, a Mad Magazine day of the Supreme Court, that they will have to sit there in all their judicial splendor and decide if oral sex can be considered by the average man to really be sex. That's insane to me. It is hilarious. At the same time, I'm glad it's not about me. I mean, everybody loves to read this stuff, but I'm glad it is in my sex life that everybody in the world knows every single thing about. Every person's sex life is embarrassing. Everybody lies about sex, especially to themselves.
Do you see this story as a tragedy or a comedy?
I don't see it as either. I certainly don't feel it as a comedy because I never can laugh at people when they're embarrassed. I think that's the cruelest laughter you can have. A tragedy? No. No one died. No horrible political movements have started. There's no oppression of people that like oral sex in the White House. It could be worse.
John Waters, he wrote and directed the new film Pecker. We'll talk more in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations and by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873, online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN, and by Princeton University Press, publishers of The Shape by the River by William G. Bowen and Derek Buck, an examination of race-sensitive college admission policies and their long-term consequences. In bookstores or on the web, pup.princeton.edu. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
I can laugh when things ain't funny. Happy-go-lucky me.
Coming up, more of our conversation with John Waters. We're listening to a record from the soundtrack of his new film. And we talk with historian Eric Foner about how the line to greater freedom is not historically a straight line. His new book is The Story of American Freedom.
I don't care. I got the moonlight, I got the sun, I've got the stars above. Me and my Philly, well, we both share. Happy-go-lucky love. Well, life is sweet, whoa, sweet as honey. Happy-go-lucky me.
sun. I don't care. I got the moonlight, I got the sun, I've got the stars above. Me and my filly, well, we both share.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with screenwriter and director John Waters. His new movie is the comedy Pecker. His early films like Pink Flamingos, Mondo Trasho, and Multiple Maniacs earned him the title The King of Bad Taste. You're in your early 50s now, and I'm wondering if your taste, or if the kind of bad taste that you particularly enjoy, is changing as you get older.
Certainly it is. Somehow I ended up making a happy movie about pubic hair harassment, lesbian strippers, trade hags, and talking virgin mothers. Who would have ever thought you could make a happy movie about that 20 years ago? Certainly the times are completely different than when I made Pink Flamingos. There's not a cultural war going on. American humor is bad taste now, and we have exported it all over the world. It has infected humor all over the world. So the American people's taste in humor, in everything from rap music to television, everything is so much closer to what I started out in that I feel like I retired from the battle of filth a long time ago, and that my imperial margarine crown of filth is firmly placed on my head forever. And I don't really feel the need to try to top anything I've done. I think it would fail if I did. I think that's up to the new kids, you know, to make movies to get on my generation's nerves, like this movie Happiness that's coming out. That's an amazing movie. It's the best movie I've seen in 5 or 10 years, I think, by Todd Solondz. But I don't feel the need to try to do that when I don't really feel that at this point in my life.
Is there anything that you find you're particularly alienated by in, you know, youth culture today?
The only kind of movies I have trouble with is romantic comedies. You know, they're not my favorite genre. When an audience goes, "Oh," I start to cringe. am I alienated by anything? Just stupidity, really, is the only thing. And I have enough success that in my life that I can finally isolate myself from that. I very seldom have to meet people that I would hate anymore, which is the only luxury you can really work for. It's much better than any material luxury you can ever have in your world, is to never have to come in contact with people that would get on your nerves.
When you see teenagers walking around with, you know, piercings all over their face and God knows where else, and tattoos all over, what does that make you think about? Do you relate to that?
I think they look cool, some of them. I think basically, though, I tell all the parents, don't care if they get piercing. That grows back. I mean, but it's the tattoos that I've said this before, but it's true. Someone will make a fortune taking all these tattoos off this generation, because no matter how butch or how beautiful or how cool you look at 20 with tattoos, I promise you at 50 you will look worn out when you take your shirt off and you have a faded tattoo of barbed wire around your arm. At 50 will not be a good look. But if I was young, I would, of course, I've had piercings. I mean, I think the tongue I like, and I think the eyebrow one is my favorite. But now they're branding. That's the new thing, you know.
Right.
So I think piercing, and eventually they're going to have Ubangy lips. I think, you remember that, like in National Geographic?
Yeah.
That, I think, is the next thing that will be coming on the college campuses.
It's kind of a plate in the lip extending.
Yes, a
the
plate
bottom
in
lip.
The lip, yeah.
John Waters is my guest, and his new movie is called Pecker. You've been managing to make movies with happy endings, no matter how improbable they are, no matter how they might seem to contrast with the larger subject matter. What do you enjoy about that, about finding the happy ending in this insanity that you're creating?
Because if we can find happy endings to our own insanity, what a perfect life that would be. I'm an optimist, a very guarded optimist, and I believe there are happy endings. And so I like to show them. My happy endings are not exactly what many people would think of a happy ending. But in Pecker, I mean, really, the New Yorker and the blue-collar sort of Baltimore people all get together and have a party at the end. And That's my idea of a perfect bar. If I could ever go to a blue-collar bar where it was gay people, straight people, go-go boys, go-go girls, all classes of people, and Patty Hearst dancing on a table, I'm in heaven.
And that's not the kind of happy ending where the audience would go, "Ah."
Well, maybe some of my audience might go, "Ah," but I'm not sure in what way they would exactly mean it. No, it's not Sleepless in Seattle ending, no.
One of the people who you discovered was Ricky Lake, who starred in Hairspray. And now, of course, she's a national celebrity with her daytime talk show, et cetera.
Right.
And, you know, she's lost weight and gotten cosmetic surgery. And in a way, I feel like she's repudiated the kind of character that you created around her. You know, someone who was considered, like, overweight and unattractive by certain mainstream people, but she was so comfortable with herself and had such kind of joie de vivre and was such a good dancer that she ended up being really attractive if you really saw her for who she was.
I think she sold that part, and that was certainly the part of Tracy Turnblad. I think physically, she probably feels a lot happier when she's not fat. And I know from Divine dropping dead from being overweight, certainly health-wise, it is a good thing for her. But when I see Ricky, I'll be honest, she still tells me, you know, "Look, I lost weight." I said, "Ricky, I don't care. You know, I'm happy for you that you do, but you could wear 200 or 80. I don't really care about how much you weigh. You know, it has nothing to do with how I like you." But I think she feels better about herself. I think she looks great. She was at the premiere in New York looking quite beautiful. And I think because she played Tracy Turnblad, that does not mean that she wanted to live the life of Tracy Turnblad. Certainly it was not good for her health to weigh 250 pounds when you're 20 years old.
You've always been based in Baltimore, and some of the people you've always worked with, like you, still live in Baltimore. At least I assume they do, because I know that a couple of them have been working for Homicide, which is the TV series shot in Baltimore.
My dearest friend, Pat Moran, who cast many of my movies, and all of them, really, and works, she won the Emmy the other week for Best Casting of Homicide.
Oh.
Vincent Perenio, who's done my production design on those, is the head production designer of Homicide. Behind the scenes, many of the people on the crew have worked with me in many, many, many of the movies. So, and Homicide is my favorite television show, so I think it's so great. Where I Live is known for Bad Taste, Homicide. You know, it's kind of the reverse of what the city 20 years ago would have wanted to be known for.
John Waters. He wrote and directed the new film comedy, Pecker. Coming up, historian Eric Foner on the story of American freedom. This is Fresh Air. The American Revolution culminated in what the Constitution describes as the blessings of liberty. Yet our nation, conceived in liberty, also had a growing slave population. This is one of many contradictions that historian Eric Foner explores in his new book, The Story of American Freedom. The book also examines the debates and struggles that have extended the meaning of freedom over the centuries. Foner is a professor of history at Columbia University and the author of books about the Civil War and Reconstruction. He writes that today, when Americans are asked to define freedom, they turn to the Bill of Rights, especially the First Amendment. Yet, he says, the Bill of Rights aroused little enthusiasm upon ratification and for decades was all but ignored.
It's only in the 20th century, I think, that the Bill of Rights came to be seen as an emblem or as a defining characteristic of American freedom. As I mentioned in the book, the 50th anniversary of the Bill of Rights in 1841 was unnoticed by anybody. The 100th anniversary in the 1890s, really, there were no celebrations. It was really in the 20th century and through the struggles of groups, for example, like the IWW and its fight for the right to freedom of speech, birth control advocates and how they were fighting against laws preventing the dissemination of information about birth control, and then a reaction against the Red Scare of World War I and the suppression of civil liberties and freedom of speech during World War I, that a concept of civil liberties as really central to American freedom began to emerge. And then again in World War II, it's in World War II that the government really promotes the Bill of Rights as a central element of American freedom, in contradistinction to the suppression of liberties by the Nazis. So again, one of my themes, not only with the Bill of Rights, but by many, many elements of American freedom, is that this is an evolutionary process. It's not that we established freedom at the time of the Revolution or the Constitution and we've just been sort of working out its logic. This is history, in other words, and freedom itself has a history. And today, it's much more central to our thinking than it was at many other points in American history.
You mentioned that the IWW, the labor movement that was the industrial workers of the world, was really important to the fight for freedom of speech and the emphasis on the First Amendment. What do you think the labor movement did in terms of calling attention to the First Amendment?
Well, there are two ways in which the labor movement, I think, plays a central role in this history of ideas about freedom in the United States. One is just the right to organize, the right to strike, the right to picket, the right to hold street corner meetings. There's a long history of freedom of expression in this country, but there's also a long history of repressing unpopular ideas. And the IWW, which was a radical, you know, labor group in the early part of this century, came up against local ordinances, sometimes state laws, making it impossible for them to organize, to mobilize, to hold meetings and propagate their views. And they violated those regulations. They went to jail, sometimes were very brutally treated in jail, and they fought against these regulations in the name of freedom of expression. And these fights galvanized a lot of other people who weren't IWW members to realize that, you know, everybody believes in freedom of speech for themselves. But that's not freedom from my point of view. It's when unpopular ideas can be expressed freely that this kind of liberty actually operates. And the IWW was one of the first groups to forthrightly challenge these regulations on unpopular speech. And the other way in which the labor movement, IWW and many others, play a role in this book is by expanding what you might call a different element of freedom, which is economic freedom. Economic freedom is a central element all the way through American history, but its meaning has changed many times. Today, economic freedom usually is invoked as equivalent to the free market, lack of government regulation, not paying taxes, things like that. The labor movement has always put forward a more substantive and positive vision of economic freedom as, in the 20th century, having an American standard of living, having a voice in economic decision-making, economic security for ordinary people. These are also definitions of freedom, which the labor movement and others have put forward as an alternative to just the sort of free market vision.
What did the birth control movement do early in the century to help define freedom of speech?
Well, the birth control movement in the early part of this century challenged laws which made it illegal to declared birth control information obscene, basically, and made it illegal to disseminate information about birth control. The post office particularly suppressed any mention of birth control devices or anything like that in newspapers or pamphlets that went through the mail. And people like Margaret Sanger, for example, were very important, again, in highlighting the repression of free speech in the name of morality, in the name of, you know, middle-class propriety by the government, by the post office department, by local judges, and really the right to disseminate this information. Now, of course, it had a feminist tinge to it because the idea was women could not truly be considered themselves free if they did not have the right to control their own childbearing. And so it was not only freedom of expression, but you might say freedom of control of your own body, which the birth control movement put forward as an essential element of freedom. And I think people like Sanger and others played a very important role in expanding this notion of freedom to personal life, to private life, to intimate relations, areas for which it wasn't really intended by, let us say, the founding fathers.
Now, you write about World War I being very important in changing a lot of things in America. And you say the wartime language inspired this sense of freedom and the desire for freedom for African Americans. W.E.B. Du Bois called on Black Americans to close ranks and enlist in the segregated army to help, quote, make our own America a real land of the free. But then you say soldiers felt betrayed when they returned, and that sense of betrayal helped spur on the movement for freedom.
Well, African Americans have always had a somewhat different you might say, experience and angle of vision about what freedom is than whites. I think this is a gross generalization, which there are many exceptions to, but I would say white Americans, by and large, have always believed that freedom is something they have and that someone is trying to take away, whether it's the federal government, the Trilateral Commission, Masons, conspirators, communists. Somebody's always attacking our freedom. Black Americans, because of their particular historical experience, tend to believe that freedom is something you have to aspire to. It's something that hasn't quite been achieved. It's something in the future. It's a process. It's a struggle. And wars have always been a key moments in which, to mobilize the population, the government puts forward very strongly ideas of America as a democratic society. In World War I, this was the war to make this world safe for democracy. World War II was fought for the four freedoms, according to President Roosevelt. And blacks, you know, basically said, well, what about us? What about a little democracy at home for us? What about the four freedoms at home in a segregated society? But the hope that this rhetoric will actually become meaningful for them has led many blacks to enlist in the armies and also to make very substantive gains. After all, emancipation came out of the Civil War. World War I led to a tremendous sense of betrayal. Blacks fought in the segregated army. They demanded that the rhetoric of democracy be brought home. But, of course, the Wilson administration had no interest whatsoever in doing that. Segregation didn't end. The disenfranchisement of black voters didn't end. In fact, very often in 1919, returning black soldiers found themselves attacked by mobs. There were soldiers lynched in uniform. It certainly seemed that the war to make the world safe for democracy somehow didn't apply to the South in the United States, let's put it that way.
Does the Constitution, which you know so well, ever feel at all to you like a tainted document because the Founding Fathers, when they talked about we the people or, you know, freedom for all, that knowing that they were just really talking about white men?
Well, I think we have to take the Constitution as a starting point, not as a fixed document, which is, you know, always going to be the same. The meaning of the phrases, the Constitution was written very ambiguously. There are phrases in there like due process of law or, you know, freedom of speech, et cetera, which mean many different things at different periods in our history. The Constitution is a sort of a general blueprint. It is not an absolute guide for action. And I think we have to take the original Constitution as a beginning point, but also understand how many great struggles have taken place in American history of groups that were not included in the Constitution to gain the blessings of liberty, to gain acceptance into the realm of we the people, and how those struggles have, as I said, changed what freedom is for everybody in this country, not just for the people themselves. So the Constitution is a beginning point. It's not the end of American history, and it's not the end of our thinking about what America ought to be.
Would you think it's fair to say that there has never been a point in American history where freedom for all could be taken for granted?
I don't believe freedom can ever be taken for granted at any point in history, American or otherwise. You know, Thomas Wentworth Higginson, who was an abolitionist who commanded black soldiers during the Civil War, said, "Revolutions may go backward." In other words, history is not just a straight line of progress. Rights can be achieved and rights can be taken away. And another often quoted sentence about freedom, which has a lot of historical truth, this was said by an Irish jurist in the 18th century, is, "The price of liberty is eternal vigilance." In other words, it's not you can never take your rights, your freedoms for granted. And certainly the history of African Americans in this country underscores that very well, because during the Civil War and Reconstruction, the realm of freedom was tremendously expanded for black Americans. But in the generations after that, many of those rights were simply rescinded, taken away, and a whole new system of racial injustice was imposed. So history doesn't, unfortunately, just move in a straight line toward greater and greater freedom. Sometimes it moves towards lesser and lesser freedom.
As we near the end of the century, what are the freedoms in America that you think are being debated now?
Well, I think that at the end of my book, I, to be very modern and up to date, although I'm kind of a low-tech kind of person, I went to the internet and searched for freedom using some search mechanisms. And I found what I guess you would suspect anyway, that today the notion of freedom is very much associated with anti-government activists. These are militia units. They are people who don't want to pay taxes. They are free marketeers. And to some extent, I think the notion of freedom has become denuded of many of its traditional meanings. I would like to see for the next century some older American traditions of freedom reinvigorated, such as freedom as economic security, freedom as liberating dispossessed people or people against whom there's discrimination, liberating them from unjust restrictions on their lives. Today, freedom is often posed against government, but there have been many points in our history when government has been, as Charles Sumner, the abolitionist, said, the custodian of freedom, where weak, dispossessed groups have looked to government activism to actually expand their freedom. And I think we have to get away from this current notion that that freedom means getting government off your back. You know, when Martin Luther King ended his great 1963 speech at the Lincoln Memorial, you know, free at last, thank God Almighty, I'm free at last. He wasn't just talking about paying low taxes, you know, he was talking about a vision of freedom as, you know, as equality, as empowerment, as dignity in the society, as really being treated fully as an equal human being. And I think we have to try in the next century to think about ways, given the changes in the market and the global economy and others, ways to reinvigorate those older but still very American notions of what freedom is and can be.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Eric Foner. He's a professor of history at Columbia University and author of the new book, The Story of American Freedom. We'll talk more after we take a short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Eric Foner, author of The Story of American Freedom and professor of history at Columbia University. The House Judiciary Committee has a grave responsibility now, deciding whether to go forward with impeachment hearings. And I'd like to ask you a little bit about your thoughts on this matter. You've studied American history for a long time. Do you think that we have impeachable offenses before us?
Well, of course, nobody quite knows what the Founding Fathers meant when they put into the Constitution high crimes and misdemeanors as the grounds for impeachment. I think it's fair to say they didn't have in mind exactly what's being considered today. And I think I don't see anything in the Starr Report or other such documents that to strike me as impeachable offenses. My opinion of I think the president has been revealed to be a rather sophomoric kind of character, but most people seem to feel that lying about personal sexual matters is not a crime against the state. In other words, what the Constitution had in mind about impeachable offenses were abuses of office and crimes against the community, crimes against the state. That's why Andrew Johnson was impeached during Reconstruction, because of a very principled battle over what the future shape of American society should be after the Civil War, about Reconstruction, about the rights of black people. The kind of matters under consideration now, I think, really don't measure up to what, you know, the process, the very severe process of impeachment really was intended to deal with. This does not mean one must admire the president's behavior, but impeachment is not the remedy. It was not put forward as a remedy for every mistake, every stupid action, and every misjudgment by a president. If that were the case, every president in our history would have been impeached.
What's your impressions of how Kenneth Starr has handled his role of special prosecutor?
I'm not a lawyer, and I'm not a judge, And I certainly wouldn't like to have Kenneth Starr investigating me, believe me. Not that I'm guilty of the acts that Clinton is, but I don't think...
Well, that was going to be my next question. We were going to go
into that. Well, what I'm saying is that one of the reasons there's a lot of sympathy for President Clinton, even among people who are kind of disgusted by his behavior, is that nobody would like to see their private life investigated in this way, that we still do believe that there is this realm of privacy. That's why when Clinton's testimony before the grand jury was put out on TV and the internet, it turned people against Starr, because they just imagined themselves sitting there for 4 hours with some intrepid prosecutor investigating their personal sexual behavior. People think that itself is distasteful. And I think that's correct. You know, there are many precedents in American history for this. You can go back to a lesser-known figure, but very similar to Starr, Anthony Comstock, who was a special agent of the post office in the late 19th, early 20th century, whose job was to root out sin in society, just like Starr seems to think it's his job, and who was one of the main prosecutors of the birth control movement in trying to keep information like that from public dissemination, and arranged for the arrest of birth control advocates, etc., and also suppressing what was considered obscene literature or poetry or novels or anything like that. Just like Starr, Comstock, in the act of trying to suppress this material, actually distributed it far more widely than it would have really been before that, because he had to demonstrate how evil it was. And you get this, the Starr Report to me is part of a long tradition in this country of what I call Puritan pornography, where people who want to root sin out from society create pornographic literature, basically, where they can enjoy reading it, but they don't feel they're sinning because they are actually trying to suppress someone else's sins. So in the 19th century, for example, anti-Catholic literature often dwelled obsessively on mostly imaginary offenses that nuns and priests were committing behind closed doors, you know. And this would be widely distributed, and people who were completely upstanding middle-class citizens would read this and get very titillated, but they didn't really think there was anything wrong with it, because we're trying to really root out sin of Catholics. Same thing with Comstock and his expose and suppression of sexually explicit material in the early 20th century. And when I read the Starr Report, it just put me back into those days. Somehow you think nothing ever changes. Here's an upstanding, God-fearing, moral man who is distributing the most salacious and pornographic stuff to a mass audience, but yet doesn't think there's anything wrong with that, because his motive is to root out sin from our society.
I think a lot of Americans are wondering now, is our president supposed to be a good role model, a man of good character? How important is that? Or is the only thing that's important the kind of policies that they enact?
Presidents are role models. And whether we like it or not, people look up to presidents and children and adults, and they do think that presidents should behave themselves in an upstanding manner. On the other hand, most Americans, being adult, realize that no person is a saint, and that it seems that we look to presidents nowadays for political leadership and economic leadership, and that, I guess, is as it should be. We live in an age of expose, which is far greater than any time in our past. But of course, everybody knows if we started investigating the personal lives of all the previous presidents, we would find many examples of of deviations from the straight and narrow course. But I think most people feel we elect a president to run the country, and if the president is doing a good job, I would much rather see Clinton criticized for his policies on welfare or gays in the military or health care or whatever other public issue is facing the country than this obsessive interest in, his private sexual behavior.
Eric Foner, thank you very much for talking with us.
My pleasure, always to be here.
Eric Foner is a professor of history at Columbia University and author of the new book, The Story of American Freedom. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Naomi Person, Phyllis Myers, and Amy Sallet, with Alan Tu, Monique Nazareth, and Anne-Marie Baldonado. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Little Brown & Company, publishers of Pete Hamill's tribute to Old Blue Eyes, Why Sinatra Matters, in bookstores. This is NPR, National Public Radio.